material recovery, you know, including probably the summary slide, really, is self is like a unicorn. It kind of sums up a lot. So any comments or questions so far?
The story is a bit stuck for me. I understand that pleasant sensational experience, they go through I've got two questions. The first question is, I don't go through that. And the other thing, I've always wondered if there's something that is stuck in the cells themselves.
Is there something stuck in the cells?
In the brain cells, yes.
Okay. You just mean the brain, or the nervous system, rather. Yeah. Okay, so two-parter, make sure I get it right, please. One part is, when I said earlier, talk to me. Chris, my God, I'm in mission control, what do you need to do? Any helpful? Thank you, Louise.
No, to your medical teacher.
Good. That's great. A lot of helpful voices all at once. Maybe we're able to get Louise. It works, Louise. It works. Hey.
I have a chair of laughter.
Yes. So, okay, a couple things. So, question one is, I said the brain, seems to stick to negative experiences like Velcro. What can we do about it? And, while positive experiences pass over the brain or through the brain like Teflon or like water through a sieve. And then the second is, in terms of, let's call it negative, not in a moral sense, but in a pragmatic sense, in terms of creating suffering or harmfulness, negative material doesn't get stuck in the brain, right? And what we can do about it. Kind of quickly on that, although it does get to something we'll be doing shortly. So it is a fact that there is what's called a negativity bias in the brain. And the brain evolved to keep organisms alive. To be alive, it's important to go get carrots and also avoid sticks. But as I think I said earlier, if you fail to get a stick today, or a carrot today, you probably have a chance to carrot tomorrow. But if you fail to avoid a stick today, whack, no more carrots for you. That's why Mother Nature wants us to make that first mistake, to think there's a tiger there, 1,000 times over, to avoid making the second mistake of missing a real tiger in the bushes about to pounce. So there is this negativity bias. And it really shows up in the slowly accumulating register of lived experience, the registration of lived experience. While positive experiences are, for most people, much more common, most people report that. Some people, sadly, tragically, have lives in which positive experiences truly are rare. But for most people, including people in, not particularly good situations even, generally have a preponderance of positive experiences. I remember a friend of mine or acquaintance of mine saying, who had traveled most of the world, said, it's really interesting for in his observation, generally speaking, the happiest people in the world are the poorest ones. That said, negative experiences have a lot of impact and urgency, so the brain registers them immediately. What to do about it? I think there are two things to do about it. One, three things really. One is, when there is a negative experience, surround it as quickly as possible with open, spacious mindfulness. In the traditional example or metaphor, if you imagine taking a big heaping spoonful of salt, pour it into a cup of water, stir it and drink it, yeah. But you take the same amount of salt, same amount of sorrow, irritation, anxiety, upset, pain, what have you, and pour it into a clean, big bucket of water, stir it around, and then drink from the bucket, you'll hardly taste the salt at all. So surrounding the contents of awareness with spaciousness, which has an edgelessness to it. Awareness doesn't seem to have an edge, therefore it has a kind of boundless quality. That itself is positive. It feels better in the moment, creates some distance, right? Rather than being in the movie, where we're sitting back watching the movie. And we're building up the neural substrates of mindfulness as we're doing it. Second, as soon as it's appropriate, as soon as the value, as soon as it's no longer productive to be aware of the negative material, gently encourage it to move on out the door. Because neurons that fire together wire together. That negative material is staying in awareness past the point of usefulness, as I said earlier, yesterday, it's like doing another lap in hell. You're just going one more lap around the track, and each time you go, you dig the groove a little deeper. Right? Help it move on. It's really important. There's wise effort. It's about pulling weeds, not just being aware of the weeds. Wise mindfulness, we're aware of the weeds. Wise effort, we start getting out there with a little digger for our friends to pull. And then the third thing to do, especially, I think, is to replace the weeds with flowers. To deliberately, as I said earlier, look for positive experiences when they're there. They're all around us, all around us, little pearls all around us, opportunities to take up those positive experiences. And when they're there, really help the brain absorb them by mindfully concentrating on them, in effect, for a dozen or more seconds in a row. And in so doing, actually, I think, and I've never seen evidence for it, it's plausibly true to me, over time, improve the capacity of the brain to register positive experiences in implicit memory. It's not so much explicit, it's not so much that you're recollecting the pearl that day, but rather you're taking in the feeling of the pearl, gradually sifting it into oneself, shifting over time one's fundamental mood or outlook or expectations or biases in terms of seeing the world. And later on, actually in a few minutes, I want to use this method of taking the good, the third of these three steps I mentioned, taking in the good, really absorbing positive experiences to feed the hungry heart, to take in healthy narcissistic supplies today, to fill that hole in the heart, and so that self, which gets very busy around that hole in the heart, can kind of calm down and come to peace. That for me, this practice, taking in the good, is a very fundamental practice for me. And I just think of all the money we leave on the table, in effect, we have a sitting, right? All kinds of very positive states of mind, therefore brain, occur during the course of the sitting, whether it's 1 minute or 45. And then the bell rings, or you look at the clock, it's time, we get up. 5 minutes later, we're back in our ordinary mind. All that stuff just swirls on through, water through a sieve. Much better to really focus on taking it in. And then as to where experiences are lodged, it's a fundamental mystery. No one yet knows, for example, when you call up the memory, where exactly you went to go get it. There's some general understanding that memory is kind of mainly supported by substrates in the temporal lobes at the side of the brain, that the hippocampus is very involved in memory. You may be aware of a patient who died recently, who, when he was young, was having some catastrophic epileptic seizures. I think he was having seizures. I don't think it was a tumor, seizures. Anyway, they removed his hippocampus. And after that, he stopped being able to form new memories. His window of experiencing, other than for anything before the operation, was about 90 seconds long, maybe 2.5 minutes. And so, we need the hippocampus. That said, I think of it basically, they are stored in neural assemblies. Generally, negative experiences get stored. Actually, this point is relevant for a practice for me to do soon, so I'll make it. The way memory works is not like the computer. The brain is a lot like a computer in a lot of ways, but in certain key ways it's different. Computer, like this slide, everything we see here, every bit of information on the image, maps one-to-one to a bit of information represented in the hard drive of the computer. We pull up a photograph or a picture or a Word document, right, into awareness, which is to say, onto the screen. It comes out. There's a one-to-one correspondence between what comes up and what's in storage. The way the brain works is that when it stores anything, basically, certainly any memory, including implicit memories, in other words, emotional memory, that's where most pain, most negative stuff is stored. Okay. Yeah, we have a handful, a few dozen, maybe, recollections of awful, yucky events. But the awful, yucky events in the first 3 years, almost never is there any explicit recollection. And a lot of other awful, yucky events are just ordinary, yucky events that are registered in the brain like that. We don't have any explicit recollection for them. But they are registered, slowly sifted down into implicit memory. Implicit memory is much more consequential, in most cases, than explicit memory. Therefore, it's the target of practice. We tend to privilege what's in the field of awareness because it's what's in the field of awareness. It's what we know. But where the action is below the waterline. And the seeds, we plant, and the roots of the weeds we pull, beneath the surface of the garment. Okay, so anyway, when the brain pulls up those little bits and pieces, it doesn't pull up a whole record, it recreates the memory from scratch, including the implicit memory. That's very efficient, and it does it quickly. So it seems like it's the whole thing, but it just builds it from scratch. And then when that memory goes back down, that implicit memory goes back down when we stop thinking about that particular content or that mood or feeling or expectation or bias or attitude or behavioral tendency, you know, that's all implicit memory. It's no longer activated in awareness, right? And that's no longer represented in the neural substrates, upper, outer frontal, more or less a working memory. When it goes back down the rabbit hole, it gets reconsolidated. And during that rebuilding, in a sense, reconsolidation period, it's very vulnerable to change and positive intervention. You can intervene chemically as it goes down. There's studies on rats who've been trained to be afraid of certain things. If you then trigger that fear memory and then shift them to something else so they're no longer thinking about it, to the extent a rat thinks about something, they're no longer present with it or aware of it, right? It's no longer active in awareness. It's going back down the rabbit hole to be reconsolidated. If right then and there you inject them with a certain drug that prevents certain kinds of protein synthesis that are involved in the reconsolidation of memory, you erase the fear memory. There are companies in America, I'm sure, probably Britain as well, that are studying how to do this in ways that can be tolerated by people who can't tolerate the drugs they give rats. the extinction of things like PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. For me, maybe humorously, maybe not so humorously, a true story, one of the main developer scientists, Joseph Ledoux, of this material, this research, who discovered this reconsolidation process or various aspects of it. As soon as his work became publicly known, he got an email from some guy who said, please, 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 can you make me forget my ex-wife? True story. Could have been a woman, her ex-husband, or whatever, partner, but anyway. So the point is that not just pharmacologically, but if you hold in awareness at the same time two things, positive material and negative material. If, in other words, when a positive memory or experience, you know, experiences are more implicit, they're more tacit, they're more sensate, okay? When you're aware of a positive experience and then deliberately sense or intuit or intend that it associate with old places of pain, old holes in the heart, that it make contact with them or kind of sink down into them. If you do that, you're bringing two things into awareness at once. Neurons that fire together, wire together, they start associating. Particularly if you hold it in awareness 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row, and then when you're no longer presencing that in awareness, you're no longer thinking about it, it's no longer the content that's there. When that material goes back down the rabbit hole for reconsolidation, it takes with it some of those positive associations. That creates a profound opportunity to heal pain and gradually soothe and replace old sorrow, old suffering, old wounds, old deficits, old lacks, old results of neglect of various kinds. To give those layers of the brain or those layers of the psyche, including very, very young ones, what they always truly needed in a very healthy sense. And we're going to do that practice in a bit, which is why, kind of out of order to the consideration itself, I wanted to answer that question.
And what you're saying is not specifically in time analysis. You're talking about pain in an environment where you're accepted. And you can say things that are, you feel are disgusting or whatever, but you're saying you're not just neutral, but
right,
in a positive attitude.
Yeah.
But meditation, in a way, is another form of
pain. Yeah. Yeah, sorry to interrupt you there. I apologize. Statistically, men interrupt women much more than women interrupt men. Well, my wife is an exception. My daughter, too. My son and I were like, but anyway, so I tried to be particularly attentive to it because there is a power element in interrupting, obviously. So her comment was, isn't that what good therapy is? Psychoanalysis or other therapies? And a good conversation with a friend. You know, you're pairing two things. And, this thing here, which is the fourth step of taking in the good, is not invented by me, you know. On the other hand, what's sort of tacit or in the flow, I think can be really served sometimes by making it very explicit and doing it very deliberately, including not just in therapy, you know, but in daily life. Again, it's this pairing. You're pairing two things together. Okay, so I'm really watching the clock here. But yeah, what? Are you sure?
Yeah.
Okay. And happy to respond too if there's a comment or something. So, yeah, that's good. Alright? Yeah.
Going back to the one that we brought up there about.
And we're
going
to take in the good later, do some things to fill the hole in the heart. And this is a really sweet, sweet practice.
The horses and unicorns. Given that you've got a response in the brain when you're thinking about a unicorn or you're thinking about yourself or you're thinking about a horse, how do we know the horse is real?
Do you mean that literally?
Well, at some level. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Okay, how do we know the horse is real? Or, to make it more, you know, like right here, right now, you know, there's a cup right here. Is this real or not?
Well, we think that.
Right. And by real, you mean tangible, material, has existence, maybe independent from any observer, something like that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's certainly Eastern teachings that suggest that everything we're experiencing is an illusion.
Right. Yeah. So y'all got that question? It's one of the great questions, right? It's occupied great thinkers, great philosophers, college sophomores with or without drug assistance, right? It's one of those questions. It's right there. I thought a lot about it, actually. And my own response is two-part. One, there is no fundamental proof either way. Because any proof arises in the system. You can, as you know, Descartes showed a long time ago, you can doubt anything. Except... This work is very, very interesting. He said you cannot doubt the fact that you're doubting, because doubting is embedded. That's right. In it, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. It really means I doubt, therefore I know I exist. Right? I know there is a doubting. I know there is doubting. I know there is doubting. So, for me, I'm at peace with the fact that it can't be proven either way. Now, personally, I think it's much more plausible to think there is a material reality for all kinds of reasons, you know, and I start there. That's me. I also happen to think that there are stranger things in this universe that are dreamed of, Horatio, whatever, and all your philosophies, that there is a lot of evidence within this realm of other realms. Even if you eliminate 99% of the evidence, I'm an evidence guy, you know, what are the facts? And eliminate 99% of the accounts of reincarnation or ghosts or, you know, intuitive knowing or other dimensions or things like that. It's an existence proof, they say, in mathematics. You only need one example, and it proves it. You only need one UFO sighting that's real. When I'm not equating UFO sightings to transcendental phenomena. So that's my short answer. What I do think, though, as a gentle kind of viewer suggestion, is that whatever may or may not be the case about, you know, astral realms, transcendental stuff, da-da, hey, we've got a lot of work to do in this plane, you know. My wife interrupts me, as she did this morning, when I was trying to say something. I can feel their reaction to it. That may or may not be some mystical illusion, I don't know, but it sure has an effect, and there's plenty of opportunity to work with it over here. To get my knickers out of a twist, in effect, right? Okay. Any more about the whole notion of self, real and real, self as a unicorn? Yeah.
I kind of comment on a question.
This person is going to enjoy his coffee because it's going to serve you as he gets, this person gets more awake.
There's a book called The Invisible Gorilla.
A quick what?
A book called The Invisible Gorilla.
It's
based on a scientific experiment. It brings together all sorts of things, including inattention, blindness, and the fact that a lot of our consciousness is created from relatively few facts.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, you know, in this space, what
I think that's a wonderful analogy and extension, so thanks. I'll use it. What he's referring to, and I'm going to spoil the surprise, unfortunately. Is it okay? What do you think? Okay. Well, you may have seen this yourself. Basically, like John Cavazzino will show this film clip, and you can see it in other settings. You can see it on the internet. And basically, what you see is this, there are different variations on it. The basic one I saw is that you've got two teams of people, probably five people. One's wearing white clothes, the other's wearing black clothes, and they're and each group is passing a basketball back and forth within the group. Right? And you're told to count the number of times the ball passes, you know, within each of the groups, just total. So you're tracking the ball movement within these different groups. Okay? And just adding up a number of times. And it's passing kind of slowly, but maybe every couple seconds or 3 seconds it passes. Right? And they show you this clip. And you're watching and you're counting. How many of you have done this or seen it? Isn't it weird? You know, it's embarrassing. I thought I was a good observer, mindfulness. Forget it, you know? And then, you know, then they stop it after about 3 minutes or something, and then they play it again. They say, this time watch really closely. And they'll show you the same clip. And then you see some big dude in a gorilla suit is walked out, you know, walking around, you know, ball's going here, ball's going there. You're not seeing it at all. Woo! And so there are a lot of studies about that sort of thing. So the point there is that we do construct, which is the way I said, the brain takes a few seeds, a few germs, and it whoop, creates a whole virtual reality in the simulator. You know, some sort of Star Trek virtual reality world, or whatever, you know, Avatar or something. You know, that wasn't so virtual, but, you know, it's this world, and, you know, just constructs it, which has a lot of implications for self. The self, too, is just whoop, kind of projected into that world. Just show it up. You know, we were talking at lunch, actually, that if I can use the example about scanning around the room, you know, not much sense of self, there is sight, there is sound, there is Rick's computer. I want a map. You know, right there. Desire. You know, we say the eye produces desire. Actually, in the Dharma, that's a discussion a lot. You know, eye produces desire. Very often, it's the other way around. You can watch it. Desire constellates a self. Right? Desire for the pleasant or for the ending of the unpleasant constellates a self a second or two or three afterward. And you can see it kind of growing. You know, swelling like a disease. Anyway, on the heels of this desire, this initial movement of desire, which is a reaction to the pleasant or the unpleasant. Okay, maybe one more, then I'll go.
The NLP people say that the brain reacts similar to real experience, imagination, and memories. How does that, I mean, is that
right? Right. Well, he says the NLP people, neuro-linguistic programming, and other people as well, talk about how, in effect, to the brain, you know, real experience, you know, that's kind of happening out there, like seeing a Mac or, you know, a gorilla running, you know, a guy in a gorilla suit running back and forth, is kind of the same at a certain level as imagined experience or recollected experience. In some sense, it is, because in the neural substrates of consciousness, in ways that are not entirely clear, that content is represented, right? Just as this material substrate of the images of the light and dark on the screen represents information, represents meaning, right? Content, signal, distinct from noise, right? In the same way, the neural substrates are representing, you know, the sound that blared earlier today, or the memory of that sound, right? Or someone trying to deliberately evoke a reaction to a loud sound. That said, what do you think would be more intense? The reaction you actually had when that sound came in versus you trying to remember your reaction or remember the sound versus, you know, kind of calling out the sound-like experience. So I think there's no substitute for real experience in the body here and now in conscious awareness. That said, deep down in the brain, it doesn't know where things come from. Kind of technically, in implicit memory, there is not source attribution. It doesn't know the source of the memory. That's why, so we can harness that fact. In other words, implicit memory, we don't recall, you know, we start feeling kind of funny. Something triggers us, okay? We don't really know the source, typically, of that which is triggered. We don't have source attribution. We cannot attribute the location of that state. But that also means that as we take in the good, as we today really bring in, for example, healthy narcissistic supplies, and we have a sense that they're going down to and connecting with younger versions of us that really long for that, deep down, it can't do source attribution either. It doesn't know that you're giving it to yourself today rather than the longed-for mother or father or kids or boss or first partner, first spouse, or whatever. Yeah, so I think that two-parter for me about it, a takeaway from this is, I think there is a difference in intensity levels. I think you're getting more neurons firing and therefore wiring when it's lived experience here and now, rather than imagined. All right. What would you rather do? Imagine that someone loves you or experience here and now someone who loves you? Would you rather recall being hugged or making love or make love, whatever? You know, would you recall your favorite dessert? Or eat it. I'd rather eat the darn thing myself, you know? On the other hand, stuff kind of in the back of the mind, sort of ruminating, you know, remembering, thinking, planning. We run these mini movies all day long in the simulator, you know, imagining what it'll be like if I do this, or it'll be good or bad, or recollecting the past. That stuff, even though it's kind of diaphanous, vaporous, sort of in the background, it's lighter, somehow it's foggier, it's gossamer-like, it too is causing neurons to fire, and therefore wire together. So, I've become much more attentive to those little mini-movies that run. You know, those little rants about other people. Why can't they do this? You know, why can't they be more like me? You know, I understand. Why can't the world run more, you know, the way I want to run? Or, you know, oh dear, I feel bummed. Or reproach, you know, complaint about others or the world. That too runs in the back of the mind. But while that's running, those neurons are firing and therefore wiring. Right? Okay. All right. So, drink my coffee before I get cold. All these nurturing people. Thank you. All right, that's good. Better. I will. Thank you. Okay. So, the group. Healthy narcissistic supplies. I've covered a lot of this ground. Great. I'm really driving to the finish line. You know, because I want to finish by 5 and I learn, keep going, you know, then you have options toward the end of the day. So, okay, the hungry heart. Healthy development entails lots of empathic attunement and lots of empathy, lots of I get it, delivered to the baby or the toddler or the preschooler or the child, or the young adult, or frankly, in adult development, here, us today. We don't stop needing healthy narcissistic supplies when we turn 21 or enter puberty. Right? And also, as part of those supplies, it's not just attunement and recognition, tuning in, it's also prizing. It's also validating and respecting and acknowledging and appreciating. Being grateful for, cherishing, celebrating, seeing that a person is special, or at least special to me. To be on the receiving end of feeling special to another person, that you, the person you are, really matters to them. You need them. It's very important for normal human development. We're deeply social. We're the most social animal on the planet by far. We really need this as a supply. This is natural. That's a generalization, of course, that then is expressed in a range of needs. Some people are more introverted. They're more kind of independent in their nature. They're less attuned interpersonally. Then you have people at the other end of the normal spectrum who are very attuned interpersonally, really looking for action, extroverted, and very sensitive to what's happening in the interpersonal field. Okay? So these normal tendencies then encounter life. All right? Because as we grow up, for many of us, for various reasons, ranging from parents just being busy or sick or preoccupied. My mom got pregnant with my sister when I was 4 months old. I don't know what my mom and dad were thinking, but there you go. Anyway, she had morning sickness throughout her pregnancy. And if you have kids or you work with kids, you can appreciate some of the impact on a little infant from a mom who just felt like crud thrown up and nausea. You know, there are two, in life in general, if you're not in pain, not nauseous, and not depressed, it's kind of okay. Right? Those are the big three. And one of the big three is nausea, because it's so like depression. It's so global. Okay. It's hard. Pain fills the mind, nausea fills the mind, depression fills the mind. Okay. So, or for whatever reason, or maybe the parent was troubled or difficult, or maybe the first year or two even was great, but then you started becoming more independent, started being able to turn away from the food they were trying to shove down your gullet, or crawl away when they're trying to get you, or say, what's the two-year-old's favorite word? No! Right? And then, wham, the hammer really came down there. Okay? Whatever it is, a lot of us grow up with a kind of hole in our heart. And then the opportunity comes as an adult to feed that hole. Because something gets very busy around that hole. It either gets busy in the form of kind of looking for those supplies today, or really sorrowing around the absence of those supplies today. You know, just yearning for and not getting today. A kind of respect or prizing or praising that was longed for in childhood and is now being transferred into the present. And self gets very busy around the hole, or self gets busy defending the hole altogether, putting a lid on it, staying away from that pain, and acting like, I'm not going to go there. Because I don't want to activate the longings for those supplies, because the longings are followed by pain. Okay? So self gets busy around that hole. So if we're interested in moving, you know, as Dogen says, toward forgetting the self, to moving beyond the self, to just relaxing and releasing selfing, it's important, actually, to deal with narcissistic needs. Right? I think this is very important. And I think it's interesting how little the Buddha addressed this. Maybe it's because in his culture, those needs were very met by community, which isn't so existent, you know, in the tattered web, if you will, of the network of community today. I don't know, but he didn't really talk much about this. Yet clearly, you know, 2,500 years ago, babies were being born and parents were busy and things like that. And these normal needs are just in the human genome. It's our nature. But for whatever reason, he didn't talk that much about it. That said, I have found that a skillful practice, a skillful means to really address a narcissistic injury as a transitional method, as a raft, you know, that we use for a while to get to the other side. So that, for example, we take in narcissistic supplies over time to fill the hole in our heart, not hopefully based on clinging and neediness and so forth, you know, give me a fix now, but as skillful means for ourselves, so that we can fill the heart, so our happiness becomes increasingly unconditional, not based on external conditions, not based on the external provision of narcissistic supplies. That's the end. Right? Tell a story about myself. This is an example of that. So I was really quite young going through school, and often I had the experience with the other kids that I was like looking at them through a wall of glass, kind of like a person outside a restaurant, you know, looking in at these people having dinner and having fun and so forth, and the person outside maybe is homeless or hungry or disconnected, lonely. Once that can't happen. I had that experience a lot. So then I moved into young adulthood. Somewhere in my 20s, I stumbled on this whole idea of taking in the good, which is present in many traditions of psychology, Eastern practices, but it's rarely explicated. It's rarely made very explicit. So I kind of started thinking about, wow, I could really do this thing. And I realized, you know, even though the hole in my heart from feeling missing a certain kind of joining or inclusion or being valued or being wanted, okay, and a lot of pain around that, and a lot of foolish acting out around that, when I finally realized that, wow, even though that hole in my heart seemed as big as a construction site for a skyscraper, kind of dwarfing the bulldozers in it, I could walk by the hole every day, throw a few bricks in, a brick a day, you know, or a few bricks a day, and gradually, as the months and years went by, you know, fill that hole in my heart. As they say in Tibet, if you take care of the minutes, the years will take care of themselves. What's under our control is the next minute. That's where we have that range we were talking about earlier, what's possible, authentically possible, in the next minute. And in the next minute, are we operating at the high or the low end of that range? So, and then over time, I can say honestly, you know, as the years passed, very gradually, and yet it seems very authentically and very really, a very deep, deep hurt and wounding, which occurred many, many times, has really, really gradually been healed. That's the basic idea. Sometimes we think that to do this, you know, to really take care of ourselves, we need to be perfect. But in this great lyric from Leonard Cohen, we're all cracked. He's a deep Zen practitioner. Leonard Cohen, the American singer and writer, phenomenal poet, by the way. His poetry is amazing. There's a really neat movie out of documentary. You may have seen it. He's the Man, right? Great documentary about Leonard Cohen, interspersed with his time at Mount Baldy Zen Center with this ancient, I think he's still alive, over 100 years today, these days, Zen master, and you too, of course, who else? Leonard Cohen, and the movie ends with them doing a song together, which is so surreal to watch Bono and Leonard Cohen doing this, whatever. Anyway, I like you two a lot. Okay, so that's the city. Hey, just because I'm not perfect, just because I'm cracked, I can still life. So, to move fairly quickly through the next few slides, and then we'll do the practice here. And these slides, I'm going to move through them fast, but they're available for you. And they're really worth taking some time with and absorbing them, especially if you work with people. And certainly for yourself. So, the three steps, the basic steps for taking the good, and this is the fourth chapter of my book, are to let a positive fact become a positive experience. Second, really savor the experience. 10, 15, 20, 30 seconds in a row to get those neurons firing long enough to transfer that experience from short-term memory buffers to long-term implicit memory storage. And then turbocharging memory systems by sensing and intending all the while, in the third step, that this experience is really sinking in. All right? In other words, for example, someone pays you a compliment or you get something done, especially something that maybe had a bit of difficulty with it. Someone acknowledges you or likes you or asks you to participate with them in some way or join in some way. That's a good fact. What typically happens, doesn't it, is the good fact occurs and we hardly notice it. We don't have much of an experiential response. We know it intellectually, we see it, we register it, there might be a fleeting pleasure. Oftentimes there's a defense against more than a fleeting pleasure, as if we would be shameful for other people to catch us feeling good about ourselves. You know, especially in certain cultures, which shall be nameless, on a little island in North Atlantic, which I've noticed myself, as a guy from the colonies. All right. Anyway, if you're saturated with narcissism, I admit it. America is such a narcissistic country. But anyway, okay, so instead of that, we want to let ourselves feel it, right? It's like the way I look at it is that we earned it. It happened. It's real. It's not bogus. They're not trying to work us. They're not trying to sell us something, usually, you know, when they compliment us. It's there. It's real, right? It's kind of like we earned it. It's our karma in a good way. There's good karma as well as bad karma. We earned it. It's like preparing a meal. We prepared the meal. It's there, right there. Don't eat it with a toothpick. Get a spoon. Big one. Yum, yum. That's the idea of perspective. Right? And you can really notice the inhibition around letting yourself feel good. How many of you noticed when I did the practice in the very beginning, it was the fourth one, you open to and encourage feelings of well-being. Let yourself feel good. Let yourself feel happy. Anybody notice any resistance or difficulty? You're like, oh, what is he talking about? Oh, not too many hands? I don't know. I think you're lying. That's okay. I'll move on. All right. The kinds of good to take in. I really like this list. It's a fun list. I basically organized them in terms of the first three categories. Yesterday we talked about three fundamental motivational systems in the brain. The approaching system, approaching the pleasant, approaching carrots, that's the first group. The second group is avoiding sticks, seeking safety, second group. Third group is attaching to us, bonding with us, or loved ones, that's the third group. And the fourth group is nonspecific. I would have put headlines there, except I couldn't have done that on one slide, so I said, what the heck? Okay? So there are different kinds of goods to take in. In a little bit, we're going to focus, on basically this one. You know, being included, being valued, being liked, being respected by others. As well as some of the first group, the sense of accomplishment. Healthy narcissistic supplies. Key point, some narcissistic supplies come to us from others who praise us or love us. Or just want to be with us or cherish us. And sometimes it comes from inside, where we realize, hey, I did get that done. Hey, there are good qualities inside myself. Most healthy narcissistic supplies are modest. They're little things. It doesn't have to be winning the Nobel Prize, right, to be worthy of having taken it in. Right. The next slide I've talked about in response to your question, how memory works, and therefore the opportunity to heal painful experiences. So I'll just move right on from this slide, which takes us to the fourth step of taking memory. So after, in effect, doing the first steps of letting a positive fact become a positive experience, second, really savor it. As every school teacher knows, if you want to help people remember something, including an implicit memory, make it as intense as possible, make it as whole body as possible, and make it last as long as possible. Right? That's the second step. Right? Intensity, multimodality, and duration, longevity. Right? So in the fourth step, there are two ways in. One way is we start with a positive experience, either deliberately calling it up, or much more naturally and commonly, in the flow of life itself. You're rolling along, there's a nice contact, you feel people like you, they enjoy your company, they appreciate some good quality in you, they're glad you did something, they're grateful to you, whatever. In the moment, in the flow of life, feel that positive experience, register it, and then let it make contact in some subtle sense, or even an obvious sense, with the painful material you're trying to soothe and over time replace. Over time, we're trying to replace weeds with flowers. The other way is we start with painful material, and then, ideally, we hold it in open, spacious awareness. First step. And then at the right time, after the appropriate, what feels right, duration and time has gone by, then what we do is we can, if we want, if it feels appropriate, call to mind some positive alternative. And allow that positive alternative to gradually infuse the mind and nudge the painful material to the sidelines, simultaneously associating with the positive material, right, in the workspace of working memory. And then when we kind of move on, and that negative material goes back down again to its own little ancient cellar, if you will, wherever it is it's stored, it can take with it those positive associations. That's the idea. This practice is common in many, many kinds of therapy. Sometimes explicitly, sometimes implicitly. Here we're talking about doing it very much on your own. As a therapist, I mean, I teach this taking the good stuff in a whole one-day course, you know, because you can unpack it and really spread it out. Quick sidebar, I think there are a lot of implications for taking the good in MBSR. A number of you are mindfulness teachers or do MBSR mindfulness-based stress reduction. And I think the opportunity in MBSR a lot is not to leave money on the table there either. But when people do access positive states through MBSR, to just take that extra 20, 30 seconds to consciously take it in. Okay, yeah.
Sorry.
Oh, no apology needed at all. Yeah.
One of the things that you've spoken about, of course, is expressing kindness to yourself, but it's not relational. It's not like you know, becoming your own therapist or any child or that kind of relationship. It's relating to yourself in a different way. What I was sharing with Rachel was...
Could you speak up, by the
yeah,
way? Because I can see you're saying a lot of good things, and it'll be hard for me to repeat the whole thing.
Right. So, where I've got a little bit of confusion, or some curiosity maybe, is around, in my way of working, it's kind of befriending the painful, the wounded part of yourself.
Yeah.
And it, in a way, it's addressing a lot of what you're saying here, but it's more relational. And
yeah.
So it's almost the sort of the subpersonal
yeah.
relation with one another. And this, in a way, is a similar process, but it is less relational. So I'm just sort of
yeah.
something that I've noticed.
It's a good distinction, if I get it. So I think of it kind of on a spectrum, you know. At one end, we might imagine literally that we are the kind inner mother or inner father, inner dear friend, with a young version of ourselves. You know, little Ricky, 9 years old, picked last for baseball yet again, because he's a little runt compared to the 11-year-olds in his class, right? That would be one way to do it, and to deliver to that younger version these messages and communications and nurturance and attitude. That's beautiful. there, that would be, for me, an example of the fourth step of taking the good. It would be one variation on it that I think is quite skillful, especially if you can do that. For some people, to do that, there's so many fireworks going on in the mind to do that. They just can't do it. It's too complicated somehow. Or it starts setting up funny dualisms in her. I've known that for some people. Some people, boy, they just super duper inner child work and stuff. But the other end of the spectrum, still the fourth step, there you are, you're having a positive experience, and you just deal with it as experience without adding a lot of things around it. It's just an experience. There you are, let's say, having the experience today of being cared about. And then after having kind of marinated in that experience for a dozen seconds or more, kind of really establishing it, you know, anchoring it in the body so you know what it is, then bringing to mind in the background, dimly, an awareness of being young and not feeling very cared about, and then simply allowing the one to associate with the other in a very direct and experiential way without much added, I would also consider that part of the fourth step of taking the good. And I think different things work for different people. I've done this for myself, where I'll start with the sort of more elemental connecting, because you could, in other words, where I'm starting with feeling positive here and now, right? And then connect, just kind of sensing this young place of sorrow and longing associated with pain, and going down there and soothing. And then after doing that for a bit, sometimes I literally will imagine little Ricky, you know, giving that guy, or imagine whispering into his ear in PE, physical education in the States, you know, it's okay, guy, you're actually really athletic, you don't know it yet. You get older, you're not a little twerp, and you know, you realize you're actually, I am actually quite athletic, not a superstar, but reasonably so. You know, then that has a lot of impact here. But the idea is to be flexible with it. I don't want to spend too much time in this taking the good, because I want to buy time for a practice in a moment. And there's more about this in my book, if you want to look at it, and also the slide sets on my website. There's a section under media called slide sets, and my website has a very good search function now, which is great. You just do search for taking in the good, blah, 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 pull it up. Then I have slide sets under cultivating positive qualities from the workshops I do for therapists about this. Okay, a couple questions, then I'll move to a practice. Yeah.
Yeah, I love this concept that bringing to mind positive experience can somehow cancel or diminish the negative one. And I've been trying it many times, but it feels to me that my mind or my brain is not obeying, and the positive experience, I know it was real, but it feels like paper or cardboard, while the negative is very strong and much more charged.
Yeah.
So my question to you is, how I can do it better?
Okay, great. So, super question. So the question, if I get it right, is, okay, I want to bring these two things together. I want to bring a positive together with a negative, all right? Right here and now, I feel cared about, or I feel liked, or I feel prized, or I got something done.
No, it's more when I have negative and I want to counteract it with...
Sure. So we have these two things together. And you're right. Actually, I'll just use that to go to this point. To do this fourth step in the capabilities, you have to be able to not get hijacked by the negative. If you're being hijacked by the negative, don't try to hold them both in awareness at once. Drop the negative like a hot potato. Just go to the positive, because if you know what the negative is, this goes, I'm going to jump around a little bit, bear with me, then I'll come back. Think about psychological antidotes. You are vitamin C. In other words, if you have scurvy, you need C. Iron, vitamin A, protein, some good pasta, that will not solve your problem, right? You need fruits and vegetables. You need vitamin C. So me, I did not need, as an adult, to kind of heal myself, experiences of autonomy and independence. Well, I didn't, or nor did I particularly need experiences of safety, because I felt fairly autonomous and fairly safe as a kid. I just felt invalidated and rejected a lot. So I needed experiences of inclusion, validation, appreciation, and so forth. That's what I needed. So when you know that about yourself, in other words, when you know what your typical pain is, here's an important point. You'll work backwards. Start with the pain. over here. What's my recurrent pain? What are my key issues? Most of us have, and there are only a handful. You know, like people say there are only seven blots in literature. Everything's a variation on seven. You know, it's the old rule, right? It's seven plus or minus two. And that's the psychology. So it's 5 to 9, right? Basic plots. They're just variations. Well, there are only so many, you know, sad stories, in a sense. There are only so many basic needs or wounds or pains. So you start with your pain. What's your recurring issue? And if you don't know what your recurring issue is, ask me and I'll tell you. No, ask your friend. Ask your partner. Ask your spouse. Right? Ask your kids. I'll tell you what your recurring issue is. Dad, you're a control freak. My wife joked with me once. She said, honey, you're obsessive compulsive. I said, no, I'm just impeccable. I was making fun of myself, really, when I did it. So, mostly. But anyway, so you see this. You want to start with your issue. Now let's say, if you want to volunteer kind of pain, you want to name your pain? Or you want to reveal it?
Anxiety.
Okay. Right here. Whoop. Safety system. Threat. Tigers. So anxiety is the issue. So even without contacting the issue, the pain, what are your body to see? Experiences of safety. Experiences of strength. Experiences of boundaries. Experiences of others standing with you and for you. Having allies, for example. Allies are so important for safety. Whatever those are your vitamin C. Right? And so then in life, when you have those opportunities to experience that, just take those in without trying to connect to old feelings of anxiety or even current ones. If a person is getting flooded or hijacked by the negative. Right? That's right there. Very important piece of skillfulness. Don't do the fourth step, just do the third, but do it in a targeted way. And trust that it really will make a difference over time. Every little bit really does weave neural tissue. A little teensy-weensy bit at a time, but a lot of little things got us into pain and suffering. There'll be a lot of little things that are positive that will get us out. Okay? Also, you've got to be able to divide attention. Little kids can't do this because they don't have the executive functions yet. Not enough myelination, which means the insulation around neurons in the prefrontal cortex to do executive functions, to do divided attention. But over time, people can do divided attention. Like if you're mindful, to do a mindfulness practice, that's divided attention. Okay, yeah.
Just to put on my mind, if that's your main pathology, if you like, or pain, then that's the one thing you're not very good at getting as well.
Yeah, that's a dilemma in a sense, but to me that's just where we start. So she was saying that if it's your main issue, right, if that's your main need, that probably means that taking in that particular kind of supply or resourcing, you know, if you will, that particularly targeted positive state is not your strong suit. I go, yeah, okay, that's right. But, you know, all right, Frodo and Sam started a mortar and, you know, and Hobbiton or whatever, you know, and they had a long way to go. That's where we start. Okay, that's where we start. But that's a good takeaway. And then sometimes what you do is you realize, wow, I'm not very good at accessing a sense of strength to deal with my history of helplessness, you know, because I was forced into helplessness a lot. So I'm not very good at that, so I have to shore up my capacity to feel a sense of strength. Okay, good. That's a target of practice. Wonderful. Wonderful. Okay. So, and you can see this antidote idea? I have this antidote idea again. It's not unique to me, but I'm just trying to make something that's sort of embedded in a lot of therapies or traditions, very explicit. What are your particular antidotes? Today we're just going to focus on one kind of antidote set, you know, they'll cross a couple categories for the general territory of narcissistic injury that tends to promote a lot of suffering. But other than that, there are a lot of other issues that call for different antidotes. Questions or comments? And we'll do a practice. A couple key resources. Self-compassion. And that gets at something I think someone was alluding to. One of the benefits of taking in the good, particularly the fourth step, is implicit. Because to do it, we're taking in some targeted content that we know is the key to our particular walk. It's what we need. It's our issue. All right? But what's also present, and in many ways I think even more valuable, is embedded in the activity is a certain stance of self-compassion, self-advocacy, self-nurturance. We are on our own side, which itself is deeply reparative, especially if we grew up or lived life with, you know, shaky feelings sometimes of others actually being on our side, or actually seeing us, or actually being for us, and being strong for us. When you do this practice, you're strongly for yourself as you do it, which implicitly is a wonderful thing to soak in. And as part of that, it's, you know, self-compassion. Another resource is an internalized sense of others being with you. It's a general resource, although it's something that we'll use specifically in this practice in a moment. I talked here about internalizing antidotes by the tip of the root. I mean, gradually over time, taking in positive resources that get all the way down in the architecture, all the way down to the basement floor of the youngest layer of the psyche, including, you know, beyond memory, where we're just plausibly speculating. And sometimes down there, through imagery or other things, we give to that one, you know, what it really needs somehow, in a way that feels like it registers and lands and actually makes a difference. We're not just making something up in our head. That's what I mean by the tip of the root. I grew up weeding dandelions. If you don't get the tip of the root, they grow back. Okay? Right. So, I think, yeah. The tip of the root, that's what this is. Getting into other layers. I'm not presuming that in this practice we'll do in a moment. We'll get all the way down. You know, but over time, that's what we want to kind of heal. Let it go down as young as possible. Try to sense down into the lowest, which means youngest, most vulnerable layer of the pain. The original seed of the upset. Okay? Any questions? Comments? Want to try something? Mm-hmm. Let's try it. Okay? So, this material here you can see, feeling cared about. And, you know, that's part of the healing of narcissistic injury, is to feel cared about. Because that's part, because that carries an implicit message that you're valuable, you matter. Right? We don't care about people that don't matter to us, in a sense. They may matter a bit, but we still care, but they matter enough for us to care about them. As you can see here, you know, when we evolved, being exiled was a death sentence. We're very, very alert. I used to be mad at myself because I would get upset about, after all my years of practice, blah, blah, blah. You're familiar with this thought, probably. After all my years of practice, why am I still getting upset about this stupid stuff? You know, I finally realized, you know, it's natural to be vulnerable to shame, to be vulnerable to narcissistic injury, because as we evolved, it was very important to track our standing in the group. Because that was life and death. It was about our standing in the group. So I went, oh, okay. I got easier on myself then. Okay, so let's do this practice here. Good. All right, so come into yourself. And just to create a context and repeat something I said before, take care of yourself in these practices. This will be the most sort of quasi-therapeutic thing we'll do today. I'm not intending to do therapy here. Yes, there is typically more value in the deep end of the pool, but make sure you can swim back by yourself. Seriously. And if you start feeling hijacked by the negative material, drop it. If there's anything traumatic, truly traumatic in your history, this is probably not the time to try to contact it in terms of the fourth step of taking in the good. Work around the edges of it, perhaps, or some of the secondary issues. I wouldn't go after any kind of traumatic material. If you find yourself getting hijacked or flooded by anything negative, like I said, go back to the positive, the pure positive. All right? Okay, so to begin, bring to mind, as we did in the very beginning, the sense of being with someone who cares about you. And then let that positive fact of knowing that they do care about you become an experience of being cared about. And then see if you can open to and encourage the experience of being cared about. Kind of giving your mind over to it. Cared about perhaps as a friend, a co-worker, a relative, a student, an athlete, a mate, a parent, a child, a lover, cared about. As with all the practices, sometimes you'll hit an obstruction. In other words, you have a positive aim, but then you hit something that blocks you. It's okay. Be with that obstruction a bit, and then, as you can, move the spotlight of attention back to whatever positive target you're focusing on. In this case, feeling cared about. Third step, sense and intend that this experience of being cared about is sinking into you. Maybe simply sense it lower and lower in your body, or sense it sinking into your back, which we often brace, since that's where threats come. Maybe you can visualize feeling cared about sinking in, like water sinking down into the earth. Or a light, a growing light, filling the shadows. And then, in terms of the fourth step, let's start with, and this is an experiment for you, somehow sensing and intending that this present experience of being cared about is sinking down into younger places in you, perhaps in adulthood or childhood or even infancy, that did not feel so cared about. Beginning with just a general understanding at first. Not even being very aware of old places of pain. Just a general knowing that this experience of being cared about here and now is sinking down into young places inside and soothing them. And it's also fine to bring to mind multiple sources of feeling cared about. Groups, other people, etc. Maybe make it a little more specific by exploring the sense of feeling cared about, sinking down into places of pain and soothing them slowly but surely. Soothing, calming, relieving those places of pain. you might find that it works to explore different versions of feeling cared about, different sources or nuances of feeling cared about, to address your particular need. If the old pain gets too prominent, drop it and just focus on feeling cared about. Keep regenerating the intensity and the whole bodiedness, the wholeheartedness of feeling cared about. Help it be as strong and full as possible, so that when it sinks down into you, it's like a full wave moving down into you, soothing and healing. Also explore taking this experience of being cared about and then visualizing a younger version of you who most needed to feel cared for, cared about, and in effect handing it to that younger version of you, that younger person, handing it or conveying it to that younger person, delivering it into that younger person. Continually encouraging that younger layer of you to open up to and receive the food that it has always longed for. See if you can sense some registration down deep in you of the receiving of feeling cared about. Kind of an opening to it. Encourage gently in that opening. If it's not there, it's all right. You can come back and do this again and again. Sometimes it takes time. But here and now, as you can, intend and encourage an opening deep down. Young and hungry for feeling cared about. A sense of the past, of younger layers of yourself, and move back to only the sense of feeling cared about. Take a big breath. Now let's move to a second kind of healthy narcissistic supply. In this case, bring to mind one or more examples or instances where you were appreciated, respected, valued, recognized, for an accomplishment of one kind or another. It could be seemingly modest, yet very, very real things, like a child simply thanking you for making lunch. Or maybe there was a moment in childhood when you scored a goal in football, or as an adult, you got something done at work that was really appreciated, respected. Or you got something done, or you overcame a challenge, and you really knew, and you know today as well, that you had to muster something to be able to pull that one off, to do that. That whole range of possibilities is what I'll talk about in terms of feeling appreciated. And so based on those facts, let that become increasingly an experience in the first step of feeling appreciated, feeling prized. Let yourself give over to feeling appreciated. Letting it be in the body, in the heart, in the face, in the throat, in the mind. And also being aware of any obstruction. And as before, if one arises, be with it for a bit and then gently move away from it and come back to the positive target, which is feeling appreciated. Second step, which you've been undoubtedly doing already, really savor the experience of feeling appreciated. Enjoy it. Let yourself have the pleasure, the positive, wholesome pleasure. The Buddha was very much in favor of wholesome pleasures, including the gladdening of the heart, as he put it. Let yourself have this pleasure of feeling appreciated. You can even explore multiple experiences of feeling appreciated. Meanwhile, engaging the third step of sensing and intending that these experiences of appreciation are sinking into you. To engage the fourth step in a very general, non-specific way. Sense and intend that these experiences you're having now of being appreciated or of worth are going down into and, in general, soothing and healing and feeding places inside you that have always yearned to feel appreciated, to feel praised, to feel special. As a kind of concentration practice, keep intensifying the positive experience of feeling praised, feeling appreciated, feeling prized, feeling accomplished and of worth. And sense that this experience is making contact with, including a certain awareness of, old places of feeling inadequate, unappreciated, devalued, dismissed. So that the current experiences of being valued are more powerful and prominent and intense and are making contact with and gradually soothing, washing over like a wave washing over a stone, washing over those old places that might feel inflamed or abraded, washing over them like a soothing balm. And then if you like, taking it one step further, conveying this experience of worth, of value, of being appreciated, being praised, taking this experience and handing it to it, conveying it to younger versions of yourself who could have really used this experience. Intending with a certain strength behind it of being on your own side, really intending that these younger versions of you really receive this experience today of worth, of value. Perhaps adding language, exploring that. Language like, little one, you really are smart. Little one, you really are beautiful. Or, honestly, those people are jerks, and you really will be seen by others someday. Or, I see you. I see your worth. continuing to focus mainly on the positive experience, prominent in awareness, with the old pain, the old hole in the heart, sensed dimly in the background. Of old pain and coming back to just the positive experience of worth, of being appreciated, praised, prized, recognized, etc., respected. Just staying with that for a moment. Regrounding in that experience and re-anchoring it in your being, knowing that it is sinking in. Okay, taking a big breath. Now one last cycle. This time, bringing to awareness some good quality in you that you're sure is there. No halo is required. Simple basic qualities like grit or determination or fair play or friendliness or kindness. Or intelligence or drive. Or aspiration for awakening. It's okay to have several of these good qualities in mind, but for sure have at least one. And then on the basis of that good fact that you recognize about yourself, that you really are, most of the time at least, this way. You don't have to be this way all the time. At least most of the time, if not all the time, you are this way. Let that good fact become a good experience right now. A feeling, in a sense, at least in this respect, you're a good person. The Buddha tells us to gladden the heart with the recognition of our own good qualities, without needing to be perfect or 100%. Expressive of those good qualities, gladden your heart here in the first step that this quality is truly in you. And then in the second step, increasingly intensify and sink into and fill yourself with, as you can, this gladdening of the heart in the recognition of some of your own goodness. Third step, sinking into this experience of your own goodness, the gladdening of the heart. And as you do that, in the third step, sensing that it's sinking into you. A conviction, a growing conviction and confidence in one or more of your own good qualities. And then in the fourth step, directing this knowing of your own good quality and the gladdening, the gladness related to it, directing that knowing and gladness down into old places of self-doubt, old feelings of shame or unworthiness or being a bad person. Continually regenerating the prominence of the positive experience of some aspects of your own goodness. Based on facts. And then now, conveying them deliberately to layers of yourself, or perhaps younger versions of yourself, that doubted, that felt perhaps like a bad person, and really conveying this knowing of aspects of your own goodness to those places inside, and being strong about conveying a knowing of your own goodness, like a wave that moves into and gradually supplants those old feelings of self-doubt and unworth. And letting go of any sense of the negative here, come back only to a recognition of a good quality about yourself, in yourself. Letting yourself feel good about that good quality. Taking a big breath. And now simply resting here. With perhaps a gentle intention that kind of reaches down into your depths and gently keeps making room for the landing, for the registration, for the receiving of these positive experiences of your own worth. well, we allow this to continue to kind of ripple and spread and marinate during a little break. Although we come back, you might want to really create space for yourself during this break to let this really ripple and register and steer clear of idle chit-chat. And come on back, if you could, please, at 4:15, 10 minutes from now.